Ann Taylor is best known for her children's rhyme, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, yet she also wrote many other words, some of which were particularly fitting for a Mother's Day. She wrote, "Who ran to help me when I fell, and would some pretty story tell, or kiss the place to make it well? My mother." Mother's Day is Lover's Day. Not love in the sense of romantic or sensual love, but love in the sense of kindness and goodness and forgiveness and loyalty and self-sacrifice. It seems to me that we have the noblest thoughts of love when we think of the ideal of a mother's love. A mother who will give self-sacrificially in order for the welfare of her children to be realized, who would indeed put her own life on the line for her children's lives and for their benefit, who would, in fact, many have, prayed a lifetime in order that their children might go the way of God. A mother who would be poor so that her children would not have to go without. And so it's fitting on this Mother's Day, Lover's Day, that we come to Jesus' great commandment to his disciples, to all of us, his command that we love one another. In John 13, verses 31 to 35, there is a sigh of relief that Jesus seems to express because Judas is gone. You've been in situations where there are a group of friends, but there's one person with whom you feel a little bit uncomfortable, someone you're not quite sure about, and you're on your guard, and then that person leaves, and when that person leaves, you suddenly have a freedom to say and do what you want, to be yourself. That must have been the way it was, as John recorded the words that when Judas had gone out, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and in him God is glorified. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him at once." Little children, yet a little while I'm with you. You will seek me. You will seek me, and as I said to the Jews, so I now say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. In this paragraph from God's Word is this great commandment of Jesus Christ, a commandment to love. And love's commandment here comes in four distinct words spread throughout these five verses. The first, in verses 31 and 32, is love's example. At first, when we read these verses, I suspect that if you were following along, you were thinking to yourself, I'm glad he has to read them rather than my reading them, because that's a tongue twister. It's almost as if John here put something that was unreadable to be read. Look at it again. "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and in him God is glorified. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him at once." We think to ourselves, my word, what was he trying to say? The repetition in there, the constant use of that word glory or glorify, what does he mean? Well, let's analyze it a little bit. The Greek word is the word doxa, from which we get our word doxology. It's a word that, as many words do, changed throughout the years, throughout the centuries. Way back in the Greek language, at first it meant reputation. But then it went through an etymological change so that eventually it meant not just any reputation, but a good reputation. And then as the word was used again through more centuries, it came to the point of being honored, a very positive reputation, of being glorified, as we have it translated here, of being uplifted, of being exalted, of being described as the highest, the position of honor, the very best. That seems rather strange, though. It seems maybe not as strange to us as it would have seemed to the Jews and the Romans of century one. Because here Jesus was anticipating crucifixion and using the word glorify to go with it. That was inconsistent. To be glorified meant to be honored. To be crucified, well, that was the worst possible, most despicable thing imaginable. That only happened to the worst of all criminals. Not any Roman citizen ever would be crucified. That was too dishonorable to Rome, even if the Roman citizen was himself a criminal. And now Jesus is saying that when he is crucified, his Father will be glorified? Oh, come now. But Jesus had here a perspective that those Romans and Jews of that first century did not have. He understood full well that when he was lifted up on the cross, that would be, in a sense, God's greatest moment. That would be the highest point of all history. That there God would be honored because Jesus, his son, had been obedient to him and had set an example of love unprecedented and unfollowed. Jesus says, now. Now in verse 31, or at the end of verse 32, at once. It's all coming together. It's happening at this instant. What Jesus was here doing was seeing all the events coming together and saying that the initiation of those events was the same as the conclusion or culmination of them all. We might compare that to what happened with those American hostages. I assume we should still remember, although easily we forget those momentous events when our busy lives take on other things. But earlier this year, when those 52 hostages at last were to be set free, after the negotiations were over and the agony had come, they fought to an end, and the rescue attempt that was futile was already history. At last they were sitting in the aircraft on the runway in Tehran, maybe even then wondering if it was a psychological trick to punish them all the more. Until that airplane started to coast down the runway, taxi, and then eventually lift off. And while they still had to go to Algeria, and from Algeria to Germany, and from Germany back to the United States, when that plane lifted off, it was as if the trip was completed, because the last impediment was removed. Well, so it was when Judas left. The last impediment was gone. And Jesus lifted off. It was as if with this final step, there was no possible going back. It was as good as done. Now, at this historic moment, God was glorified. We say, oh, you know, that's great, that's marvelous, that's wonderful. It's a good retelling of the gospel story. We need to hear that. We're glad that God is honored. But what does that have to do with love? And wherein does that relate either to a theme of a worship service or the commandment of the 34th verse? How did those things tie together? Ah, but you see, love. Love is the whole point of the cross. For while our sins made the cross a necessity, God's love made the cross a reality. For when God said, I love you, it was far more than empty words. Therein was the beginning of the action of the expression of that love. Jesus, in every step he took, was expressing his obedience to the Father and his love for us. It's as if he took a few steps toward the cross and then paused and turned and said, I love you. And then a few more steps. I love you. And a few more. And I love you. In his going to sacrifice, he set for us the example of love. That tremendous sacrifice of himself. It was glorious. It was magnificent. It was our example, so that if ever we want to know how to love anyone, we look at Jesus Christ. And therein we see love in flesh. As he loved you, so love one another. A second word in verse 33 is the word of love's necessity. The words of this 33rd verse are really packed with a touching emotion that we cannot really begin to recapture. Jesus is bidding his disciples farewell, disciples whom he dearly loves. He calls them my little children. That expression in Greek is used here only in all of the Gospels. and elsewhere in the New Testament, only several times in the epistle of 1 John, a relatively infrequent expression, an intimate parental calling of children. Imagine with me for a moment a mother who knows that she's going to die and has put off as long as she dare the telling of her children. She would far rather that she tell them than that someone else tell them. And while the exact moment has not yet come, she knows that the days are coming close. And so she brings all her youngsters around. She has thought 100 times and more exactly the words that she will speak. How can she tell them? How can she say it? She knows that at the time in their young lives, they probably will really not understand. But she figures that someday, long after she is gone, then they may recall the words. They might have a great impact upon their lives, so she must frame those words in the most careful of ways. With her heart pounding, she wants to be clear, but she dare not be blunt. She says, my little children, mommy's going away for just a little while. You've heard me talk to other people about it, and now I'm telling you, you're going to miss me, and I'm going to miss you, and where I'm going, you can't come right now. And then that mother looks into her children's eyes. She sees all kinds of things. She sees that while the words have not communicated all that she knows to be true, that there has been a communication of emotion, that they feel that somehow something very important has been said, that the moment is very sad, very special. And then she goes on. And she says, my little children, there's one thing, just one thing I want you to do and I want you to remember while I'm gone. And that is, I want you to love each other very, 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 very much. You see, my darlings, when I'm gone, I won't be able to love you then as I do now. And so I want you to love each other as if I were here. I want you to make up for my love. I want anybody that looks at you to remember me by the way you love each other. And so it was that Jesus said, little children, yet a little while I am with you. You will seek me. As I said to the Jews, I say to you, where I am, you cannot come. And so in Jesus' departure from this world, he asked his disciples one thing, just one, to love one another. It was the one mandated necessity. He wouldn't be here. He couldn't love them quite in the same way he had in the past. And so instead they were to love one another as he loved them. The world would no longer be able to benefit in general terms from his immediate presence. And so if they were to know the love of Jesus Christ, the only place they could see it would be in the love that his disciples would have for one another. Love's necessity was and is that we carry on for Jesus in the living out of his grand example of love. Now add to that the third word of verse 34, which is actually love's command. Remember, again, the context of this whole story. Somehow as we study it verse by verse, we have a tendency to forget some of the things that have gone before. You recall that Jesus' disciples, in time, only a short distance back, had been arguing with one another about who was the most important and who was the greatest of all, as self-centered as could be. I suspect that only of those of you that come from homes with more than one child can understand how Jesus must have felt as he talked to those disciples that day. As parents, we have those times when the children are after each other. They're sort of climbing the walls, and you're trying to go away, and you're trying to get into the car and get the dog out of the car and get the kids in the house, and you look at the babysitter, and the babysitter looks like, you know, she's ready to collapse already, and you haven't even gone yet, and the children are in their worst possible behavior, and then you have this tremendous word of counsel to them: behave yourselves, love each other. They look at you like you're completely bonkers, and then you say, now you do whatever the babysitter says. It seems so out of context with their behavior. You wonder if they could possibly do it, if they could possibly listen. If that's in a sense what Jesus did. He told these disciples who were arguing and hassling and doing just the opposite of what they ought to be doing to love one another. Let's analyze what he said. First of all, he said, I give to you a new commandment. But was it a new commandment? Back in Leviticus 19:18, God had commanded his people, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Oh, then it wasn't new at all. No, it wasn't new in content, but it was new in motivation and in scope. In motivation, in the Old Testament, they were motivated by a law. They had to do it. God said, this is the way it is. Now, instead of being motivated by law, they were motivated by love. Jesus had so loved his disciples that that by itself was to become the motivation for them to love one another. Add to that greater motivation, the far greater scope that in the Old Testament, the commandment was to love your neighbor as yourself. That's tough. To think that we are to treat other people and have attitudes towards other people, at least of the magnitude that we have toward ourselves. But now Jesus goes infinitely farther and says, love one another as I have loved you, not as you love yourself. Not that fluctuating standard of self-love, but that infinite steady standard of divine love. We read things like that, we're almost bent to a tendency to write it off because it's so impossible. And we say, how on earth do we do that? I mean, it's one thing to psych us all up with the motivational stuff, but on a practical basis, how do you do it? What do you do every day to have that kind of love? Let me give you a list of some suggestions. First on that list is to recognize that the highest priority is for Christians to love one another. Now, therein is no excuse for hatred toward non-Christians, hardly at all. But the first priority of love is fellow Christians. Methinks that's not always the way we do it. Sometimes we assume that we should have appropriate and loving behavior for witness purposes to a non-Christian, but we can let our hair down and be informal, in fact, in some points, be unloving toward fellow Christians, because there we think there ought to be an acceptance. Not so, says Jesus. The first priority is that we love one another. It's more important, if in fact there's a choice, and there is really no choice, but if there were, it's more important to love fellow Christians than to love non-Christians. Our first love commitment is to the Church of Jesus Christ, to fellow believers, to the household of faith. Now, recognizing that, a second suggestion is to pick some specific people to love. Play the game with me for a minute. Can you think of some people? Two or three people that you can etch on the chalkboard of your mind, people that really need love, Christians, mind you. What are their names? Who are they? And when you have two or three of those, add to the list not only those who really need love, but those that you would naturally be least likely to love. What Christian might be an antagonist? What Christian might be someone that you would normally dislike? Someone who gets under your skin, someone who's ripped you off, someone who's taken advantage of you, someone by human standards, even though a Christian might be classified as an enemy. For after all, didn't Jesus say in Matthew 5:44 that we're to love even our enemies and those that persecute us? A few years ago, I took a psychology course in graduate school that had a teacher who told us to all close our eyes and to imagine that we're walking down a long corridor. And it's sort of dimly lighted, except at the far end where the lights are brighter. And there's going to be someone that is coming from a perpendicular hallway and is going to turn the corner, and soon we're going to see that person. It's the number one person you don't want to run into. It's the person that you don't want to talk to. It's the person whom you least like. It's the person you want to avoid. And this professor took us step by step with our eyes closed down the hallway, and we could hear the footsteps of the other person coming down the other hallway, and then the corner was turned, and there he was. Who was that in your hallway? Who's that person that you'd be least likely to love? Put that person on your list. Or maybe you don't have enough acquaintances and Christian friends that you can think of anyone either that needs to be loved, or you don't have a close enough circle of acquaintances in the Christian community that you have any enemies. Then perhaps the second item on your practical list of things to do is to become more deeply involved in the community of faith. Or else, how could you ever fulfill Jesus' commandment to love one another if you don't even know one another? A third suggestion is to pray for those people that you've picked. I've discovered a tremendous power there. I think the natural human inclination is to go to people, maybe manipulatively, to bring them around so that we have the right relationship with them, or to try to shape ourselves up by human initiative so that we can be the way we should be with that person and flying in the face of all the circumstances. But I found it's far more effective for me to pray daily for people either that need special love or people that, frankly, are coming down my hallways. And I've discovered changes have come after sometimes weeks and months or years. First in my life, and then in their lives, and then in our relationships together. If you really want to love one another, pray for one another. And then a fourth suggestion. A commitment to think and speak the best of fellow Christians. When a person isn't there, what you say about that person is probably one of the best opportunities to express love for that person. How often we have the opportunity to either lift someone up or put someone down. Sometimes we hide behind the excuse that what we say is true. But remember that there is no order within Scripture that we speak all the truth. Very often there are occasions when we can speak the truth when we ought not speak the truth. Not that we lie, but that all the truth is not needed because of the commandment to love. There are many things that are far better left unsaid. What happens when a person's reputation is entrusted to your lips? What do you say about that person? Is it your commitment, in that person's absence, to always speak that which is best of your fellow Christian? A fifth suggestion is to build up people. Just make that the way you function, that you're always building them up. How can you make someone feel loved, either someone on your list or someone else? How would those people most feel loved? By a gift? By a note? By a telephone call? By being invited out to dinner? By spending time with those people? How can you make them feel loved? By God and by you. A sixth suggestion is to avoid anger. Jesus became angry with the money changers in the temple, threw them out. He became angry with the religious leaders, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But you never see him expressing that kind of anger toward his disciples, toward those whom he loved in this very special way. And so every time you or I become angry with a fellow Christian, that's the time to stop. First of all, asking God for his forgiveness, and then asking for the forgiveness of the one with whom we have been angry. Asking God to cool us off and to behave as we ought with that person. Never excusing angry behavior toward those we ought to love. A seventh suggestion is make a list. A love list. Things to do and to say for the good of others. I've had people tell me, even within our own church community, that a birthday rolls around and no one says anything or remembers it. If that person were to forget his or her own birthday, then it would be forgotten altogether. Why not find out the birthdays of a half dozen fellow Christians and make the commitment that if everyone else forgets, you'll remember? Or in a far more serious vein, what about those who in days or weeks or months or maybe even years gone by have been widowed or have some other way lost a dearly beloved family member or friend? You know, when the disaster strikes, when the death comes, Then there are people that send sympathy cards, and make long-distance telephone calls, and send flowers, and come cross-country for the funeral. And there's a busyness and activity level that by itself is therapeutic. Oh, but a month later, when there are no more cards and there's little mail and everyone has gone home and no one says anything about it, then the desperate loneliness comes and then the need for love is greatest. Why not put on your list the names of those who last month or a year ago on this date lost a loved one and show the love of Jesus Christ for that person? Imagine the kind of list that Jesus Christ would make, a love list for other people. And you make that list and do it. And an eighth suggestion, before you speak or act, ask yourself the question, is this word, is this deed motivated by love? Put those eight items together, and you have a practical way of fulfilling the commandment of Jesus Christ. One, to recognize that the highest priority is the love for fellow Christians. Two, to pick some specific people to love. Three, to pray for those people. Four, to think and speak the best of fellow Christians. Five, to build people up. Six, to avoid anger. Seven, to make love lists. And eight, to always check yourself before you act or speak by asking, is this motivated by love? I'll be frank with you, but you know it already, that not all Christians love one another. Lord Byron wrote that Christians have burnt each other, quite persuaded that all the apostles would have done as they did. Throughout history, some of the most vicious things have been said and vicious things been done by Christians, one to another. Some of the ugliest of wars have been fought between Christians. It hurts me, and I know it hurts you. Certainly it hurts the heart of God that such terribly inconsistent and disobedient behavior come in the lives of those that bear the name of Jesus Christ. Like you, I have too often been hurt, deeply hurt, by the words and the deeds of fellow Christians. And like you, I have too often, with my own deeds and with my own words, deeply hurt fellow Christians. There are Christians who gossip and who lose their tempers and who think the worst of others. Christians who are vindictive. Christians who steal from other Christians. Christians who write unkind words. Christians who harbor unforgiving resentment. Christians who lust for the husband or wife of another Christian. And more and worse. But knowing all this full well, the issue is not others and what they have done and have not done. The issue is us. Will we obey Jesus when he says, "A new commandment I give you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another"? What about it? What do you say? How do you respond? Will you love others as Jesus loved you? Finally, a fourth word in verse 35 speaks to love's effect. Francis Schaeffer says that this verse is frightening. Quite a description, isn't it, of a verse that comes from the lips of Jesus. Schaeffer writes that Jesus turns to the world and says, "I have something to say to you. On the basis of my authority, I give you a right. You may judge whether or not an individual is a Christian on the basis of the love he shows to all Christians." Isn't that incredible? That Jesus Christ issues a license to non-believers, that they can make a decision, a judgment, of whether or not we are believers, of whether or not we are Christians. Non-Christians can decide whether or not we are disciples of Jesus Christ. It's true. It's true that they may do that on the basis of our love for one another. Our love for one another is the criterion for judging our salvation, our faith, our Christian lives, our discipleship. Now I'll tell you, I see it all the time. I see people about whom I have zero doubt either of their salvation or faith or discipleship. You know why? Because they live lives of loving other people. loving fellow Christians. They're there when they're needed. They are people that are given to hospitality. When somebody is short, they're the ones that offer money. When someone's hurting, they're the ones that help. They go to parents and offer babysitting. They go to those that are in the hospital and offer comfort. They're the ones that send the notes and make the telephone calls. They're the ones that are concerned about the poor. They're the ones that are willing to sacrifice. They're the ones that pour out their lives. They're the ones that are sensitive to others. They're the ones that make the lists, that say the kind things, that do all the stuff we've talked about. Oh, it's inconvenient. At times it's costly. It may indeed require sacrifice. But to those disciples of Jesus Christ, that's all okay. The disciple of Jesus Christ has been loved. And so he loves in turn. You can tell. You can tell who's a Christian. You can tell who's a believer. You can tell who's a disciple of Jesus Christ by this one criterion: love for one another. Back in the 4th century, Jerome wrote about John the apostle, the evangelist, who wrote this gospel. I'm not sure if you know this or not, but tradition says that of the 12 disciples, 11 died violent martyrs' deaths, and one lived to old age and died of natural causes. And that tradition is that John was the one. And so Jerome tells us that when John was getting into very advanced years, he was feeble, he was frail, couldn't walk. When he would come to church, he would have to have friends carry him. He would babble on, talking incessantly, saying the same things over and over again. And so Jerome tells us that as John was carried to church, he would say to those that carried him, little children, love one another. Little children, love one another. Little children, love one another. One day one of his friends asked him, why you always kept saying the same thing? Because, John said, it is the Lord's commandment, and if it only be fulfilled, it is enough. Little children, love one another. For it is the Lord's commandment, and if it only be fulfilled, it is enough. Father, may we indeed love one another as you have loved us. Lord, let the world judge us, and let them see that we are disciples of Jesus Christ because we love one another as Jesus loved us.